Welcome to Charting the Course, a podcast from Full Sail Capital, dedicated to providing you with insights, assurance, and confidence to grow and manage generational wealth. Full Sail Capital is a fiduciary registered investment advisor managing more than $1 billion with a focus on integrity, competency, and transparency.
My guest today is Peesh Patel. Peesh is an entrepreneur, author, and philanthropist, among other things. In this interview, we get a look into his life story as we hear about challenges, successes, and his unique perspective on his path to generational wealth. In order to give Peesh enough time to tell his story, we're going to break this episode into two parts. Here's the first part for today. I know you'll enjoy our conversation and hope it serves you along your journey. Peesh, thanks for coming by and joining David and I today. You have such an interesting story. I would love to just get right into it and let you tell it. Is that okay?
Sounds great.
Tell me about your parents, your childhood. Paint me a picture of what it was like growing up for you.
I had a really interesting childhood. So I moved from London when I was 4 years old to El Reno, Oklahoma, of all places. And my parents picked El Reno because it's right at the crossroads of America. So they said Highway 81 and 66 cross right there, literally a block away from the business that they put in. They bought a little motel. My parents showed up with $16. And they have worked 7 days a week since 1978. And so it's just a hardworking. I grew up in this kind of, if you're old enough to look over the counter, you're old enough to serve a customer. And they had a little motel. You know, they didn't come with a lot of financial knowledge, right? And that's kind of the challenge. So my parents ran the business by figuring out how much they had in the bank by just calling the bank. And it wasn't until years later that I was like, wait a minute, you've written checks. Like, you probably need to reconcile the account. And they're like, what's that mean? They would literally just call the bank and go, oh, there's $5,000 in the bank. So we have $5,000 to spend. And that's how they ran their business, right? So really simply.
Would you say they were successful motel owners at this point? Look, with your business acumen as well?
I believe they were successful. They made a lot of money. And then late 80s, when the banks all flipped, they were in the middle of all that and lost it all. That made them incredibly cautious. I was a middle schooler at that time, and it made me very cautious. I mean, my parents had us pack up the whole house, and they were like, look, the sheriff is going to come any day and seize the motel, so we got to be ready to pack because we only have 24 hours to leave. And we lived like that for like 5 months. Just, you know, you'd open a box like, oh, I guess we get to open this closed box today. We're not having to pack this one. They just went through, you know, this great growth and then a great loss, which for a long time made me very conservative about money.
I think I can know the answer, but growing up that way, did you think that generational wealth was a topic that you needed to familiarize yourself with?
Let's see. My parents bought a $30,000 life insurance policy, and they thought, kids, if something was to ever happen to us, you all are set. Right. So, I mean, that's the extent of generational wealth, because I think the fact that they showed up with nothing, there was never this idea that somebody else is going to take care of us. And so I've really tried to bring that to my family now. It's not that this gift is for you. It's just a tool.
You grew up, graduated high school. And what career options did your parents present to you at that point?
Yeah. So my parents are cleaning toilets. Right. I mean, let's get brass tacks about it. They're cleaning toilets, right? But they told me, no, you're not allowed to clean toilets. Your job is to go be a lawyer, a doctor, or an engineer. And those are your three choices. And, you know, being a good Indian kid, I said, okay, well, not really into medicine and not really good lawyer type personality. So I'll go with engineering. I'm good at math. You know, most Asians are good at math. So I'll go with that.
And what sector of engineering did you choose?
So I was drawn to electrical engineering. In high school, I had this hustle of building car stereo speakers and things like that. That was big in the, you know, late 80s, early 90s. And I can understand the math. I could do the geometry to build these systems and compete with these systems. And so, you know, it's really funny how you look back at things. I had a full ride to go do an electronics degree in Weatherford. So it'd be kind of an applied physics. And I decided, no, I don't want a full ride to a small school. I want to cut my teeth at a bigger school. And in hindsight, looking back, that could have been, a really life-changing moment. I had this idea, when you listen to music in your home, your couch affects it, the walls affect it, So you're never listening to it the way the artist initiated the sound, right? So what I thought we would do was put microphones in your room, capture the sound that is being heard, compare it to the sound on the CD, and adjust the sound to match, and do it all in real time. So that's in high school. That was my dream. I'm going to go invent this and build this. Needless to say, it's out now. I had nothing to do with it. It just took them like 20 years to figure it out.
That's a significantly greater thought process than I had in high school. I was just unsuccessfully chasing girls.
Exactly.
So you chose electrical engineering. You stuck with it for how long?
I did it for 3.5 years. And
so were you a semester away from graduating then? What did you switch to?
I got to give you a little backstory on why I switched. I switched to elementary ed.
And yeah, that's a natural transition.
Yeah, you know, I walked in and I said, hey, what can I do with all these, you know, engineering classes? And they're like, oh, you want to be a science teacher? Yeah, I'd love to be a science teacher. They're like, how about middle school? And I'm just getting roped into like probably one of the worst jobs in America, right? Maybe in the world.
Most dangerous, yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, middle school science teachers have to teach sex ed. So, you know, I wouldn't trade that for anything.
Oh.
But the reality was all my friends were getting jobs building missiles. That's kind of what these kids would graduate and go off and build missiles. And I watched the movie Gandhi on the Campus Network channel. And I thought, yeah, I've never seen this movie. I'm Indian. I should probably watch it. And after watching, I thought, I can't build missiles. Like, that's not in my nature. Much like skiing is not in my nature, right? I'm a terrible skier because my people don't ski. So, you know, I decided I'm going to go with this nonviolent. And so I told my parents, I'm going to be an elementary school teacher. And my dad, he saved every nickel, every penny they went without for years just to put me through college, right? Because they're like, that to them was the generational wealth. It wasn't, we're going to hand you money. We're going to hand you an opportunity, right? And we're going to move all the obstacles out of the way so you can go. So you can imagine my parents' surprise when I told them I'm going to go be a teacher. And my dad said, well, if you're smart enough to be a teacher, you're smart enough to pay for it.
What lessons do you feel like you learned during that time period with whether it's sticking with something hard like electrical engineering or switching whenever something doesn't work that you feel like you apply today at this point?
I think that's a really tough one, right? Because it's all hindsight. You can look back and go, oh, yeah, it worked out great, right?
Or it
couldn't have worked out great, you know? I was so naive that thinking, you know, making $28,000 a year is just fine. Like, I can raise a family on that. And then you try to raise a family on that, and you're like, oh, yeah, it's not college anymore, right? Where $200 will last you a month. All of a sudden, you're in the real world, and you got mortgage, you got life, and $28,000 doesn't go very far.
Eating ramen for a month is romantic until you do it.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, so it was, I learned a lot. I learned, you know, really, it's, you got to follow your heart and passion.
I'm going to skip ahead a little bit, and then we'll come back. Danielle Foster, why I bring that name up during your college time here?
Yeah, so let me give you a little backstory here. This is a few years ago, maybe 6 years ago. I'm on vacation with my family in San Francisco for spring break, and the phone rings. And on my phone, it says, you know, Burns Hargis, the president of OSU. And I look at it, and I was like, I look at my wife. I don't even answer it. I look at my wife. I'm like, that's weird. She goes, answer it. I was like, okay, hello. He's like, hey, Peach, this is Burns, the president of OSU. And I was like, I know who you are. He's like, listen, I don't need money. I'm not calling for money. And I was like, oh, okay, now I'm interested. He's like, I need you to do me a favor. I want you to come and speak at the graduation. And I was like, okay, let me call you back on that. And I told my wife, what do I have to say? And she's like, are you kidding me? You better go. So the next day I called him back and said, yeah, I'd love to do that. He gave me like 3 months head notice. And I was looking at my goals, and I keep kind of a running list of bucket list goals. And one of them was to put a stranger through college.
Mm.
And I was like, how do you do that, right? Like, do you pick a freshman and bet that they make it? Do you wait until they're a senior? And 3 days before this speech, I come out of the shower, and I was like, Lisa, I got it figured out. I'm just going to pick a random person in the audience and pay for their college. And she is the voice of reason, right? Like, I come up with these ideas, and she goes, you know, you might want to run that by somebody. Yeah. And I was like, yeah, I probably should run it by somebody. Well, it turns out that's a lot harder to do, right? There's privacy issues. There's all these issues. But I told them, look, you've got 3 days to figure it out. right? Like, this could be a life-changing gift for somebody. I'm going to give you 3 days to figure it out. And they said, okay, do you want to know who it is? I was like, nope. You can tell me the day I get there. And so I had never met this young lady before, but in the middle of graduation, during my speech, I talk about making an impact in other people's lives, right? And so what better way to do it than just to do it? So I called her name and she stood up and she kind of looked around like, why is he calling my name out? And then I paid for all of her college. Like, all her student loans were forgiven, outstanding bursar, and then she probably used a little bit of money to get started.
Did you give him any specifics for that page? This is the kind of person I'm looking for, or yep. Was it just wide open?
It was essentially wide open. I just asked, I don't want a straight A student. Straight A students have already got an upper hand in life, right? I'd like that hardworking B minus.
Yeah. Just,
right? And this young lady worked her tail off, paid her way through college. Her parents couldn't come to graduation because they couldn't get off work.
Wow.
Yeah, this person has worked hard, right? And is continued to be a science teacher. So we want that.
Cool.
And it's continued. This is what's great about this, is ever since that day, it has continued at every graduation. So if you ever get the call, yeah, if you ever get the call to come speak, kind of need to bring a checkbook, you know?
Yeah, get ready to pay for college. That's great.
So sometime between being asked to return to speak and graduating from college, you did a few things to kind of earn that right and have the financial means to pay off those student loans. How straightforward was that path?
Let's see, the path to success. Dexter, if you and I could figure that out, we would have another level of success, right? Because it's just it's an emotional roller coaster. It's a financial roller coaster. It's a stress roller coaster. I mean, it's all the above, right?
Yeah.
We started the business with $54 and no investors and no debt. And then grew it to be this international business where every major studio was using our product. That's just fascinating. Like, what a roller coaster, right? Oh, to start with nothing. And I pause all the time and go, man, could we have done that today? No, right? We were eating peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, and making $500 was like life-changing, right? So when making $500 is life-changing, you approach the business very differently than we got to make $5,000 in the next hour just to keep the lights on.
What did you do after graduating college then with your elementary education science teacher diploma?
So I taught middle school, loved it. I did a unit on astronomy, and I always start with like, let's test your knowledge. What do you know about astronomy? And I get the hand in the, hey, right here. And I'm like, yes, it's like Cancer and Libra and Gemini. And I was like, well, no, that's astrology. And honestly, Dexter, I spent 30 seconds on it. The next day, I got a letter in the mail that said, how dare you teach my child about the occult? And that went to the principal's office, and it went to the superintendent's office. And I mean, it became a big deal. And really, I came home and I told my wife, I want to change the world. These parents won't let me change the world.
What year was that approximately? I just asked.
98.
I feel like teachers today say the same thing about parental involvement kind of hurting, and it doesn't seem like it's a new phenomenon is what you're saying.
It's not. It's been around.
So how did you then progress in changing the world if you didn't feel like you could do it in the middle school science realm?
Yeah. So I got a job teaching at a local college, Northern Oklahoma College, and I taught advanced computer graphics there. So we were teaching multimedia, animation, that whole process. And it was very early in that very early stage. And there I could really start to make a difference, right? So the real challenge for me in that program was it was a 2.5-year-ish program. And the software was changing so fast that by the time you started the program, you're already two versions behind by the time you graduated the program. So really all you did was spending all your time going, what's new in the software? Never mastery. So I walked in one day, got on the Regents agenda, and I went in and made a presentation. And I said, I think we're teaching this wrong. I think we should teach this in one semester. And they're like, wait a minute, what do you mean? I said, well, I think we can teach 42 credit hours in one semester, and then they'll graduate, and they'll go straight to work. And they were like, okay, who's going to teach that? I was like, I'll teach it. And they said, well, you know, we can only pay you up to 18 hours. And I thought, well, that's better than 12. Okay, I'll do it. So that meant my students and I, we worked Monday through Saturday, 8 a.m. to 6 p.m., half-hour lunch, and no holidays. So we never took a spring break. We never took Thanksgiving. We worked that whole semester. And then these kids would go off and get $50,000, $60,000 jobs for their $2,000 degree. I mean, it was really life-changing.
Wow.
So the idea for the business came from these kids would knock on my door. I lived across the street from the college. And they would knock on my door at 10 o'clock at night, at midnight, you know, hey, Mr. Patel, my computer's not working, or I didn't understand what you said. And it was all fine until my wife got pregnant. And then she's like, hey, you're going to need to have this stop. And so I just started recording the day's lessons, and they quit coming to my door. And one day, one student said, you might want to put this out on the internet. I bet other people would like it. So I made a whole new batch of content, put on the internet, and yeah, people really wanted it.
So at some point here, you've got a lot of nouns that follow your name with high school, middle school teacher. I keep saying that. I apologize. Professor, husband, father to a growing family, and author as well. David, you had said that he wrote a textbook. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, that is one of my favorite stories, Paige, when you talk about your experience. Why don't you tell us how that was a nice little lesson on the wealth creation path, the probably a path you don't want to go down if you want to work really hard and not make a whole lot.
That's right. Yeah, you know, it's so funny that you say that and you remember that. I wrote 7 textbooks as a professor. Some I was the author, some I was co-author, a few I was kind of the main editor, make sure they're accurate. And it was really interesting that I got 50 cents per book. One of my books sold 100,000 copies, right? Now, I think you hit 10, 15,000, you're on the New York Times bestseller. This sold 100,000 copies in the first quarter. So it was a major textbook. And these were $50 textbooks, and I got 50 cents. And then they were like, you know, when we get the second edition of this book out, you only get a quarter. And I was like, well, but you're keeping like 99% of the book for the second edition. And they're like, yeah, we understand, but you're only going to get a quarter. And after that, you get nothing. And so I was like, huh. I need to be on the 49-50 side of this equation and not the 50-cent side of the equation. Needless to say, once we started my subscription company, it was $49 a month.
That is fantastic.
With no pricing research. It was just, I wanted to be on the $49 side, so it's going to be charged $49.
I love that. I love that. So this podcast, we know we talk a lot about generational wealth and creating it, growing it, managing it. We don't talk a lot about leadership and being an entrepreneur, but your skills there as a leader, as an entrepreneur, those things are really what led you to your wealth, to your generational wealth. I've heard you talk about it before, but kind of help our audience understand, in your opinion, the difference between being a leader and an entrepreneur.
So I think everybody's a leader, right? You lead your family, you're right. A leader in your community, in your neighborhood, in your friend group, at work, right? People have this idea that leaders are in a certain office and they have certain responsibilities. I think everybody's a leader, right? You're a leader at the grocery store, right? Are you going to let somebody with 3 items in front of you? You make that choice, right? And you present that to that person. Like, I got a basket full, you got 3 items, go ahead. I will lead the way, right? Entrepreneurs, I think, look at the world a little differently. A lot of people say entrepreneurs are risk takers. I don't think so. I think we're highly calculated risk takers. Mm. And we're willing to bet on ourselves, right? So ultimately, I think that's the big difference is entrepreneurs are willing to bet on themselves. You know, the wealth that is created from that process is generated differently, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's not generated by yourself. It's generated by leading other people to get that work accomplished.
That's awesome.
Very few one-person companies generate life-changing wealth.
Right.
Right. You've got to have people and have
people. Or as you put it, a tribe.
Yeah. You got to have a tribe, right? And your tribe have got to go to battle for you.
Yeah.
And to take care of each other.
That's so good.
You speak about it in your book, Lead Your Tribe, Love Your Work. But what role did culture and BAM, that idea of belonging, affirmation, and meaning, play along your wealth building and business building journey?
It's funny you say that, Dexter, because I think culture is really the key competitive advantage of any company. Give me enough time and money, I'll recreate any business that's out there. And that's easy to do, right? What I can't recreate is the culture, right? That is set up on purpose. Now, a lot of people say, yeah, you know, we're not intent about culture. Well, then you have one, right? You may not like the one you got, but you got one. So why not be intent about it, right? Why not allow people to play this awesome game of that we call business? And a lot of times people just go, no, it's just your job. No, I think it's a game, right? And everybody loves playing games. So let's teach them the rules. Let's teach them, where's the foul line? How do you make points? What's the time limit of this game? Let's play the game, right? And I think people show up to work for belonging, affirmation, and meaning. Mind you, you got to get paid, right? So that covers your food and shelter. You need this Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? Bottom two are food and shelter, safety. Safety is done with, hey, we provide health insurance or we provide retirement. We're going to take care of you, right? But after that, it's all about, I want to belong to something bigger than myself. I want to be affirmed for my work, positive and negative, right?
Mm-hmm.
The worst thing you can do is to tell somebody, good job, good job, good job, and then pull them aside and go, hey, we got to let you go. You're not doing a good job. Well, if you would have just told me, I would have changed whatever you need me to change, right? So I think it's important to say good job, but it's also important to say, hey, you kind of dropped the ball, right? Let's get that ball picked back up and let's get going. And the last one is meaning. Everybody wants their work to mean something. And it doesn't matter if it's menial answering the phone. That is probably the most important job in the organization, right? It's the first point of contact.
Yes.
So it's just how you approach it. How are you looking at everybody's role in helping you accomplish the long-term vision?
So kind of with the BAM as being the backdrop piece, post-COVID, we look back, so many companies that had just a very thriving culture at work, and the BAM was working, right? That belonging, affirmation, and meaning. And then the businesses are shuttered, and hey, we're working from home, man, everybody. How do you see BAM? How do you see that changing? How do you see what the impact of that on business coming out of COVID, and what do you think it's going to look like post-COVID?
So there's always going to be a percentage of people who love working from home, right? And I think you have to have a personality type that loves to work from home, right? We had 500 contractors that worked from home and they loved it. And we sought them out. Like, you like working from home? Yep. Then you're perfect for this. But if you like working around other people, then you want to come to the office. So I think what you're going to see is, yes, everybody had to disperse to go back to home. And people are really struggling with that belonging, right? They don't belong to the tribe. They're kind of this outpost by themselves. At some point, you're going to see this massive pushback to come back into the office, to be around people. You know, a lot of decisions get made in the hallway.
Agreed.
A lot of decisions. And when you don't have a virtual hallway, you don't have, you know, you really get into just, I need work to be done. And that's a real dangerous thing, right? And here's why I say that's dangerous. Once that becomes the norm, then we can just get the work done cheaper. Right? Because now it's not really about taking care of people. It's just about getting the work done. And if I get the work done in Malaysia, well, I'll just get the work done in Malaysia.
Right.
Right? That's not good for our community.
Right. And it's kind of hard when you have someone working in Malaysia for you to use really one of your measurement tools for whether culture was working or not in your office was what the toilet paper situation was. Got to tell you, I died laughing when you first told me. We've been friends a long time. When you first told me about this, this appealed to the Larry the Cable Guy part of my brain for about 20 minutes, and then I had to come back to the business side. but because it's truly amazing how you use this, and I think it's appropriate. Talk about the first time you started actually going, hey, I'm going to put my initials on the toilet paper in the bathroom. We're going to start monitoring this.
So look, when the business is growing, right, we had 42 full-time, 500 contractors. There's more nuts and bolts in this thing and lots of moving gear. Everything is just happening at once. I can't walk around and check, did everybody do everything correctly?
Mm.
So much like driving a car, I needed to just find one gauge, right? And either it's going to be the speed or the gas tank. Those two, I think you can figure out most of getting around by watching those two gauges. I really didn't have those gauges for me from a cultural level. I had them for a business level. I knew, you know, how many people were on our systems at any time, how much money was coming through, how much we were spending. I knew the financial piece, but not the culture. I didn't have a gauge.
Right.
And so I came out of the bathroom one time. I went into the bathroom, and the toilet paper was empty, but the roll was still on there. And I thought to myself, okay, look, we have a really good culture here. But in the moment when nobody was looking, right, somebody's true character came out, which was, I'm going to use this and F the next guy who comes in.
Yeah.
Right? I don't really care. Not my problem. Right? They'll figure it out.
Yeah.
And that's just not the kind of organization we are, because the way we work, almost everybody touches everything. So if you're willing to do that when nobody's looking, what are you really doing at your desk? So I gather it up, everybody. And it's so funny because my wife said, look, the girls don't have this problem. It's just you boys. But that's okay. I'm going to gather everybody. And I said, listen, this is the way it's going to work. If I walk in to the bathroom after you and the toilet paper roll is empty, that's your last day. Mm. And I'm a three strikes kind of guy, and I'm a uncomfortable conversations kind of guy. But I was like, I am drawing the line in the sand and essentially saying, if that's how your character is, you don't belong on this ride.
Wow.
Right?
I can tell you, after my wife read your book, this became kind of a divisive cultural impact at my house. As she rolled out of the bathroom one day going, we need to have a cultural meeting the Stanley family because there's no toilet paper. I was like, you can't fire me, honey, but I'll get better. I'll get better. But I love it. I think it's funny to talk about, but it is what the whole premise of it is so true.
Yeah, it really is just a tiny litmus test. Is everybody working well together, right? Are we looking out for each other? Are you checking my work to make sure I don't make a mistake?
Right.
And am I checking the next person, or do I just not care today?
Right.
Right? That's how I read it. And so I just drew a line in the sand, and you know what? We never had that problem again.
So that is incredibly unique. But I also thought the way that you handle pay increases and how you would promote people was just as unique. Kind of walk through that.
The first time I gave a major raise, it was like a $10,000 raise. I sat him down in the conference room, and we were like, you know, we said all the right things, and they looked at me with the shock in their face. And they're like, okay, should I go back to work? And I'm like, go back to work. Like, no high fives. No, like, where's the champagne? Like, how does this work? Right. I just gave you 10 grand. Now you got to think, like, starting with $54, that is literally opening my wallet and giving him 10 grand. Right.
Right.
And that was the investment I wanted to make in them. So what I realized was that 10 grand, yes, is important to them. But that 10 grand impacts their family way more. So from that point forward, I quit doing raises in the office. I quit bringing them into the conference room, which we call the principal's office. Instead, I would invite them and their partner to dinner where I could gloat on them, tell them how much we appreciate you sharing them, and then say, I'm going to give your family a $10,000 raise. Now, here's what I created, David. I created an advocate in their home.
Oh, yeah.
To where when they say, I'm just so tired, I don't want to go to work today, they're like, get out of bed. You work for one of the best companies out there.
Brilliant.
And so I have an advocate in their home that also understands how important family is to us.
That is just brilliant. There is nothing like having that advocate at the house, right. I can tell you. Whoever's on that pillow across from you has more weight and influence in you than anybody else in the world.
Absolutely.
So that's cool.
Absolutely.
So you had that whole kind of benefit and just being satisfied. Hey, I'm taking care of some of these. They're taking care of me, but I'm taking care of them, my employees. And even in those times when you and Lisa couldn't take a salary because you had to make it, you had to make payroll. Yeah, when the money started finally coming in, and you started really like things were going well, and you were able to kind of get a couple creature comforts for yourself. I want to talk a little bit about that because I know you're a huge Thunder fan and a car guy.
Is it okay if I ask him about the Thunder? Because I'm a giant basketball fan.
Yes, there you go.
So I'd be curious, what are a couple of the most memorable Thunder games that you have attended?
My goodness. We sat courtside for years. I think the most memorable was... my wife and I were sitting there. It was a loose ball. One of the players, I can't remember his name, one of the players comes running, charges for the ball, misses, smashes into my wife, hits his head on her knee. And of course, my wife is so, you know, tries to be very quiet. She's just tearing up. And I was like, are you okay? I'm okay. But then Stephen Adams runs up and he's like, "You okay?" She's like, "I'm okay." He goes, "All right, get up, mate. We got a game to play." And I was like, that's just him, right? Like, and he was laid out for good 10 minutes. I mean, I had to bring the stretcher and the whole nine yards. But he's like, "Get up. Oh, you shake it off. Come on, let's go. We got a game to play."
Oh, wow.
I have never heard an Indian try to do a New Zealand accent before. I really enjoyed that. I guess also kind of along the lines of Stephen Adams, who is the most physically imposing player either for the Thunder or for the opposition that you have seen on the court? Just who would you pick first for a street brawl?
Oh, my goodness. Well, you know, I'm going to go back a little bit of time here. I think Harden would be a great street brawler. Yep. But I think Russ would be a great brawler to his speed, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, he would hit you so fast.
He plays basketball like the game of basketball has wronged him.
That's right. That's right. And it was just awesome to watch that, watch kind of that history of Oklahoma unfold.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was really cool.
And David is much more of a car guy than I am, so I'm going to pass it off here.
So the car guy, every time I get to go to your house, I get to indulge in that part of my fantasy life. Your first real, like, when I say car, you know, fantasy car guy was a Corvette, wasn't it?
It was. I mean, that's just American muscle. Mm. I know I'm going to anger Ford and Dodge people, which is fine. Those are great cars too, but there's something about a Corvette, oh, yeah, right? That is just American muscle, and it's a fantasy car.
So, okay. So you bought one, right? So tell us about your experience of buying your first Corvette.
I had a goal. By the time I was 30, I was going to own a Corvette. Now, when you make that goal at 16, 30 seems like forever away. So I had a whole lifetime to figure out how to get that done. And it's 2 days before my 31st birthday, and I tell my wife, I gotta go get a car. Like, I gotta make this happen. So I'm not gonna say the dealership's names.
Right.
But I go to one of the big dealerships here in town, and there's a black Corvette, and I didn't want a black one. I wanted an orange one, but I'll take a black one. And the guy said, "Can I help you?" I said, "Yeah, I'm interested in buying this car." And he said, "Oh, you are? I'll be right back." And 45 minutes later, he never came back. And so I thought, okay. So I went to the next dealership. They had a yellow one. Didn't really want a yellow one, but I'll take a yellow one. The guy said, "You know, you're not allowed to test drive this car." I said, "I understand." He said, "Let me get my manager." And then that guy never came back.
My God.
So then now I'm starting to get a little like, I wonder what's going on here. So I go to the third dealership. The third dealership, he just made it very clear. He goes, "Son, are you going to finance this car?" I said, "No, I'm going to write you a check." He goes, "Okay. You know, most of the people are like twice your age that buy these cars." I said, "I understand that, but I've got a goal set," and all, you know, told him the whole story. And he's like, "You know, I just don't think you're going to be happy in this car." And I was like, "Oh," and I left. So I get home and my wife's like, "Where's your car?" And I was like, "Believe it or not, nobody would sell me the damn car." And she's like, "What are you going to do?" I said, "You know what? I'm just going to get online." So I found a car dealership in Dallas. I said, "I'm looking for an orange Corvette." And he goes, "I'm looking at one right now." I said, "Okay, I'm very interested in that. What do we do here? He said, "How about this? You meet me at Windstar Casino, which is right at the border. I'll drive the car up. If you like it, you drive it home. If not, I'll take it back." Okay, can we do this? "Well, I'll get the keys right now if you want to meet me." Okay. David, I bought a brand new Corvette in the parking lot of a gas station.
Wow. That almost sounds sinister.
That guy couldn't care what color I was, what age I was, what I did for a living. He just understood the check would clear.
Yes. Right?
And I came back and I told my wife, I was like, "This is the future," right?
Yeah.
I've owned two Teslas. I got one more on the way. I love them because that's the buying experience. They don't really care who I am. They just know I'm a customer. I took that lesson to my business as well, right? Like, we don't know who we're dealing with.
Right.
And they could be a beginner or they could be very advanced. But every beginner will one day become advanced, right? Let's make them a lifelong customer and a brand loyalist. But let me tell you a flip side, a different story, right? On a Ferrari. So I didn't know this, but you can't just go in and buy a brand new Ferrari or order one. That's a big no-no. You have to buy two used Ferraris before you're allowed to buy a new Ferrari.
Wow.
So I bought a used Ferrari from a friend, and it turns out that doesn't count. You got to buy it from a dealership.
Wow.
So I really wanted this 488 GTB. Can't get anybody to sell me one. And then I thought, you know, I'm just gonna ask a very simple question. What if you have a great customer who now can't take the car because of life, like a divorce, a death, a loss of a job, whatever, right? And the guy says, you know, never thought about that. We always kind of make them take it. I said, well, could I assume it? Yeah, I guess you could. Great. Here's my number. Call me if that ever happens. And he goes, yeah, that's a good idea. I thought, that's a great, that worked. So then I called six other dealerships, gave him my number. Call me if you ever, and a guy out of Chicago calls me and says, I got a great customer. He lost his job. His car has just showed up. Are you interested? And I said, well, he's going to have to eat the down payment and I'm going to take it as it is. Just, you know, I'm going to take the sticker value of whatever it is. And the guy said, no problem. I'll have it on a truck today.
Wow.
And so I think there are rules, but I think if you're just nice, right, and everybody wins, the rules bend a little bit.
That's cool.
We're going to stop there and pick it up next week, where Dave and I shift the conversation to how Peach has handled his newfound generational wealth.
All opinions expressed by the host and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Full Sail Capital. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. Clients of Full Sail may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast. If you enjoyed today's conversation, please review and subscribe through your preferred podcast platform. Have a great week.